This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Let's go wider, because this case isn't just about Corey Richens and Eric Richens. It raises questions about how this kind of crime gets detected, how juries are supposed to weigh evidence when there's nothing definitive to point to, and whether the story the public has been following for 3 years is even the same story that the jury is being asked to decide. Eric apparently suspected something was wrong. His friends knew the marriage was in trouble. His sister hired a private investigator. He'd already quietly met with a divorce attorney, and he still ended up dead. Let's talk about this a little bit, not necessarily about what's going on in the courtroom, because a lot of people are going to look at this case, and this is kind of just more of opinion, more of a conjecture type question. And I'm going to go to you first, Bob, and I want to get from you, Robin, too. The question I think a lot of the jury is going to be looking at in this whole thing is, why didn't y'all just get divorced? Why didn't we just go there? How did it get this bad that one is literally fearing for their life, having to set things up legally in case I get murdered by my spouse, my funds and my money goes over here? I mean, if you're already in that mode and you're fearing for your life, a lot of folks who've never been in that situation will say, why didn't you just leave? I mean, if you're in the situation, you can speak to it differently. But it's complicated. It's emotional. It's a mess, especially when you got three kids involved. But Bob, I mean, how would you answer that question if, you know, a juror is you're having that question with a juror at a coffee shop after all this, and they're just going, why didn't they just leave? What the hell are they thinking?
I mean, it's the same question I ask myself. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's inexplicable. You know, yeah. I never understand why I'm always screaming divorce. Just get a divorce. I think in this particular circumstance, I think that we got a little bit of a mind's eye into what Corey's mindset was. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know how deeply religious Eric and Corey were in terms of the Mormon religion, where divorce is obviously frowned upon as it is in most religions. You know, I don't know if that was even an impediment for them at all.
As is murder.
Right.
Usually that ranks higher, but sometimes people are surprised after the fact. They're like, what do you mean murder's bad?
But divorce is a two-way street.
I was following Nephi, like Lori Vallow likes to argue. Right. Be like Nephi.
I mean, that was a whole different type of crazy, Lori Vallow.
Yeah.
All different types of crazy.
Yeah. Robin, what do you think?
You know, it's, I think, and we covered it a little bit yesterday too, Tony, you know, hope keeps us alive a lot of times. And, you know, just thinking about Eric's point of view, you know, as he's saying, making all these statements, and to some degree, you know, Corey's claiming she did too, that my wife is going to kill me, you know, just because you think it doesn't necessarily mean that you think the person's capable of it as well. You know, because when you look at her, you are living with her, you see her interact with kids, you know, you have hope, you have those things, and you have believability and the lack of our understanding of our own mortality and how fragile our lives can be at the hands of someone who's really intent. So it's tough. But yeah, I mean, why not just divorce? It's people, you know, we get addicted to our habits that we have. And if you have a habit of being together, if you have a habit of chaos, people, I mean, Corey's a great example. She's addicted to creating chaos. And as well as Eric might have been addicted to just being married and dealing with that chaos. And so anything that upturns that apple cart, you know, we generally don't do. Plus, we don't know. I mean, it doesn't sound like we have any kind of trauma bonding going on, but, you know, we just get addicted to these things. And then the kids play into it as well, you know, the impact of kids. As Bob says really well, you know, we don't know what was going on in that family on a day-to-day life, but, you know, we can have some conjecture from what the dad was saying and the other family members that Eric was a really, really good dad. And if he was worried about the impact of divorce on his kids, he might be reluctant as well.
Yeah, 100%, man. And that's always a thing. I mean, you hear that all the time, that people stay in bad marriages because of the kids, which is the worst thing.
I did for 10 years.
Yeah.
I was thinking of you, Tony. I really was.
Yeah. I mean, and you fear. I mean, look, if you're in a situation where you're dealing with somebody with a personality disorder or something like that, you fear. I mean, you're like, okay, at the end of the day, am I, what's worse? Me dealing with this and taking the heat, and hopefully it never comes, I'm going to be murdered, but it can. But I'd rather be there and protect my child over 50% of the time having zero control over what's coming and going around my child's life. And a lot of parents will take that bet. We'll take that risk. Reality, it's not the safe risk. It's not in that moment, it seems right. Long term, when you're out of the picture, you look back and go, probably still not the best idea, because if that person is capable of killing, they're capable of killing whether you're there or not and those around you. And that's the reality of it, and a risk that you're going to have to take. One of the levers has to be pulled. Either you're going to wait till it goes to the absolute shit and you are putting your life on the line, which many of us get to that point, have been myself, or you get out early and then you deal with the repercussions to that. But it's a calculated move for a lot of parents. So I get where Eric was on this.
Hold on, Tony. I want to add one more thing that I think a lot of people can relate to, just in a work context. I mean, how many of us have actually been someplace or been the person ourselves where we're in a work context? So it's not even as consequential as family, where you've had leaders that are inside incredibly toxic organizations that actually stay in place instead of quitting to protect the people under them from the crap on top. That's even a small microcosm. They're willing to take that weight and burden on themselves to protect those under them. And so it could all stop. Yeah. It's just a real world example too.
I want to talk about one more thing here, and that's the congruence of Corey Richens' behavior, because I think that's the problem. I know it's one of Robin's hot words.
That's my favorite words. That's why you saw me smile.
Congruence. Today's show is brought to you by Congruence. It's something, obviously, when things aren't congruent, things feel a little off. And things certainly feel off here in the Corey Richens story of she's this widow and her husband died because he was using drugs, illicitly and secretly. Big surprise to her. She's innocent. They were going to work on the marriage and all this. That's not congruent with reality. She was cheating on him. We don't know what else was going on. Everything that's continuing to come out. But the thing is, Corey had a propensity to move in the motion of whatever was going to benefit Corey most. That's, I think, the lesson that we're learning here. Need some money? Steal from your husband. Need more money? Well, steal from your best friends from childhood. Take their life savings that they're thinking you're going to be putting into the investment property that they're investing in. You need more money? Go take out a payday loan to rob Peter to pay Paul. The track record of Corey's reality versus the image that she's trying to portray are two very different things. Now, I'm not saying that they point to her being a murderer, but they show one where she's completely full of bullshit and the other one where it's a completely different story. And if you're trying to come into this with credibility for a jury to go, yeah, we believe you when you say you didn't kill your husband, having a track record that isn't filled with all lies and taking advantage of everyone and everything in your life doesn't exactly help.
Yeah.
I'll
take this one all day. It's a softball, man. And again, I'm going to go back to that earlier part of the conversation where I thought that the most compelling witness in terms of giving you and I, like, you and your ilk, the people that kind of feel that way, a mind's eye into if Corey was being financially abused and controlled by Eric, which I think that she was.
I still need to see more evidence. What evidence was that of it, that other than her saying, I feel trapped to a friend, which seems like it was simply feel bad for me?
Well, I think that there was a prenup that gives you kind of like a from initially, like when you kind of look at a prenup and it's prudent in many situations, this is a situation where we're in. I don't know that either of them were married prior to.
Eric was, I believe.
But it is only one data point.
Yeah, right. And they have, she's the mother of his kids, but she has no access to the funds really at all. Like, I mean, when it came out, when she says this thing that I feel like I'm a kept woman, that he's controlling everything. Like, I want to become financially independent.
But she's taking like hundreds of thousands of dollars from him.
All right, can we?
I don't know how she's kept and being held back.
He didn't start by taking hundreds of thousands.
No, it started small and it built up.
No. What happened is the problem that we have with Corey is that she's a fucking awful business person. Like,
yes.
She doesn't, like, she decided that she could do this flipping business, and she quickly realized that she wasn't good at it and that she was in over her head, and she was buying property. I've seen it.
Like, I don't think she thought she was bad. I think she thought she was good.
She didn't. I assure you, she was okay. She was absolutely panicked.
She's kept
the
digging.
Point where it's all falling apart.
Yeah.
Like, that's again you pretending like you know who Corey Richens is.
Well, but just kept digging. Well, she kept digging. I mean, she did.
She tried to dig herself out.
I got to tell you, I love Bob's empathy. You know, Bob has the ability, as you know, you can tell Bob's Retza as a defense attorney, understanding the point of view of his client. I mean, that was just, you know, and that's what he does. It's just, but to everyone's point, though, we're talking about congruency here. Her congruence of her behavior of chaos is really at that life arc that she's had the entire time, and potentially immoral or bad actions. You know, and so I'll make that leap. Just because someone is unethical doesn't mean that they can kill someone.
No,
so I get that aspect of it.
I agree. I'm just saying it's not congruent, the behavior of I'm a good person. And
congruency, like it's a black and white thing, and it's not. It's gray.
It's a pattern behavior, though.
Everything else. But is it? Because, again, if you've got a woman who's like, all right, like I'm in this marriage that seems loveless or whatever, mm-hmm. whatever's going on with her. And she, as I said earlier, she's concerned about what divorce looks like in terms of the three people that are most important to her, which are her kids. Mm-hmm. In terms of Eric's, the family has all the money. The family has all the power. I'm going to be that woman who's going to get destroyed in court because Eric's going to get the best lawyer possible. And I'm going to hire some schmuck and I'm going to get hammered. Eric's going to get. So her other approach is like, okay, I'm going to try to become financially independent. I'm going to start my own thing.
Eric's, I'm not faulting her on that.
Dude, let me finish it.
Okay.
So because you're faulting her on things when the business starts to fall apart. And what I'm telling you, I've seen it firsthand. I've had clients
okay.
that have been in this like exact situation where when flipping was the thing. And they thought it was easy. Everybody, you could flip. You just buy the house, you rehab.
Put some shiplap and you're good.
Right. And the realization is that when she started taking all these balloon notes out and everything started to, the other shoe dropped. And when a balloon note hits, it's all due. And if she's not able to get the work done and the rehab work done and pay for the materials, and she keeps buying the properties because she's a really bad business person, desperate times call for desperate measures.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that ultimately leads her to doing the HELOC scam, right?
Yeah.
So, like, my point being, she didn't go into it wanting to be a thieving, conniving scumbag. It's like she ended up being that out of necessity to try it, and she's panicking. Like, she didn't go in trying to rip her best friend off. That thing fell apart, and she was always counting on the next deal closing in order to fund everything else that was behind it. So it was just a snowball for her that just ended up. But ultimately, that being the case, that could have been the motive for her to kill him. So, like, I'm not excusing it in any way, shape, or form, because that absolutely could have been the only way I see out of this.
Yeah,
is killing Eric.
Sure.
So, like, I just give the weight that I think, again, you know, it's just I have professional experience and kind of dealing with these things. So I look at it a little differently.
You do. Yeah.
You know, but like for me, I give that the weight that it deserves, which is not that much. But ultimately, in terms of a linchpin type of motive, it certainly is a big motive because it got to the point for her where I don't think there was any way for her to get out of it. You know, because, you know, but the counter argument that be like when she closes on the mansion, that seems incongruous to me that would have been theoretically, excuse me, her one opportunity to make everything right. But, you know, like what we haven't gotten a ton of in terms of when I'm saying making everything right, is I don't know where the foreclosures were. Like, I don't know where everything was in all the properties in terms of the legal process.
Sure.
Like the ships of may have already have sailed. You know what I'm saying? To where if she's able to flip that thing and turn it around, you know, and again, the relationship with Grossman, I mean, it's like Robin said, I don't think that she had any real feelings for that poor guy.
No.
I mean, she was clearly using him because she had a lot of properties that she needed a lot of work done on, and she didn't have the money to pay for it. So what he did is she created a relationship with the guy who could do the work, and she was going to say, yeah, I love you. We have this relationship. We have a future together. Oh, in the meantime, can you get all that work done for me?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like, I'm not excusing any of her behavior because it is what it is.
Sure.
But in terms of like trying to get to that ultimate question.
Yeah.
Did she do this? I don't know, man. And
I think that an important question that came to my mind, somebody made the comment, HGTV made everyone think they were home flippers. They did. There was that trend for a while. But my question is, how many marriages did HGTV ruin? Because, or did people ruin their own marriage? You know, obviously after watching too much HGTV, and then one of them starts thinking, oh, I can go do this. This looks really easy. And how many marriages were ruined? Not ending in murder, but ending in just financial destruction, because some people invested in far too much shiplap and just shit went to, you know, everything hit the fan.
And I think, you know, one of the really congruent things here, and again, yeah, you know, Bob, you may always make a great point. We don't know what's in her head. We don't know what's in her head, but the result of our observations of every action she took that wound up chaos was, it was always, always self-serving. She took advantage of not, and I'll go with you on this, you know, probably not intentionally. No one wakes up in the morning and says, today I'm going to be an asshole and take advantage of everyone in my life.
I did yesterday.
No, you said that to me before too, Tony. You know,
it was a bad Monday for a lot of people.
Why am I friends with Tony? but to that point, you know, if your life arc is always, result is that it's all your actions are always about you, and I think that's what they're presenting to the jury as part of this is that the motive of me and the path of destruction. Now that doesn't necessarily mean you're capable of murder, but it definitely puts it in the realm of possibility.
Well, let me ask you this, Robin. I mean, like, why is everything me if she's trying to start this business and she's just not good at it, right? But She wants the business to succeed. I mean, like, I don't necessarily take that as a meme. Like, everybody who starts a business wants to succeed.
I think that her methodology is again, only from the optic that we see, which we don't see everything because we're not here, her, and we're not in her life. But the optic that I see from what's being presented is the results are continually disastrous for herself and everyone she touches in her life. And a lot of times for people that are more outwardly focused, they take accountability for their own actions. They own up to their own behaviors. They share what's going on. They seek help from others, and they're open and honest with their communication. They're transparent and they're vulnerable. Those are actions that are actually trying their best to serve others. But when you act with a lot of secrecy, when you act with a lack of transparency, ultimately that behavior can definitely be interpreted as a self-centered behavior. That's why I kind of jumped to that.
Yeah, but I mean, the pushback on that is we don't know.
Right. And I caveated it. We don't know, but it's the observed behavior.
All you've heard is the state's theory, brother.
And I said it. And I said it. I caveat. You know, I hedged my bet on
Eric asking him to help. I mean, we know that she went to CNE and got a loan on one of them. So there was a point in time she wasn't sneaking around doing anything.
I guess I'm laying it mostly on probably from what we know about.
Which is the state's theory of the case, cherry picking.
Well, and the forged signatures on the life insurance policy.
And stealing from her friend, the waitress. I mean, there's
she didn't steal from her friend.
I'm going to hang it on the forged signatures.
She didn't put the money where she was supposed to.
I mean, they closed on the house, though.
And also, the boyfriend that, you know, got duped to travel across the country, that wasn't serving him. That was serving her. You know, so again, it's cherry picking data points. And I do my best too. I don't have the reps you do in this, but and I think, you know, even during a conversation about this case, I'm extremely open-minded all the time for new data coming in, always. And I am excited. And like you said, you know, I love that statement. If you don't feel like she's guilty at the end of the prosecution's case, then the prosecution hasn't done their job.
Right.
You know, and then, and now we're going to really see the reverse flip of it. And I'm curious about what we are going to see on that. But also, think about this book. Again, I'm cherry picking data points. Was that book really serving her kids, or was it serving her and the optic she's trying to control?
It depends, right? If she did it, then it's the most self-serving, horrific, disgusting thing I've ever seen. It's like the most warped thing. I mean, it's what put this case on everybody's radar was the book and the concept that she killed her husband and then wrote a grief book.
An op-ed. Yeah.
It all depends. Like, I just want to feel secure in any conviction. That's the bottom line. I don't get lost in the minutia of like, oh yeah, she was a complete a-hole to everybody in her life. She was self-serving. That may all be true.
And this goes to my burning question. This goes to the burning question I've had throughout most of the show, Bob. And this is, I'm so curious about this, and it might waver from case to case. And I love, again, I learn something from you every time you're on. And
appreciate that.
You're
willing to listen, Robin. That's the thing.
You're so dedicated. One of the reasons why, at least I took away, I'm paraphrasing on you, is that you're so dedicated to the defense attorney because you want to make sure things were done right and that justice is served according to the law. And I think that is extremely profound and righteous. At the same time, you know, you're trying to prove someone innocent, or I mean, so where's that balance between innocence and make sure it's done right? And does it fluctuate from case to case? I mean, I don't know. I'm generally really curious about that.
It's a great question. And again, it depends on the case. Like if Nestor and Lewis went to Corey Richens and said, okay, which I'm sure they didn't, because it's not the job of the defense attorney to go, again, this isn't TV. So you're not saying, Corey, did you do this?
Right.
Now I have to try to work around and like get you off. Like it's explicitly why you don't do that. Right. Because your job is your job is your job is your job.
Right.
But when you're going in and you're going in and saying, okay, look, this is the evidence they have. My client, and 99.9% of the time, our clients say they didn't do it. Like, just like understand that is kind of like the base jump off point. 99.9% of people that are arrested say they didn't do it.
Does believing them ever matter to you
when they come in? Huh?
Does believing them ever matter to you?
No, it doesn't, because it doesn't affect my job. So what happens is, and again, I think like I always like to point out there's this misconception that everything goes to trial. Nothing goes to trial. 95% of cases are pled out.
Right.
So most of what is going on in the courtrooms in this country is plea agreements, because the state has the evidence. The defense attorney's job switches from trial lawyer to I'm trying to get my client a reasonable plea because the state is overcharged. Let's have the punishment fit the crime. And so that it becomes a negotiation, right? So that's a majority of the work. So when you get to the point where you're going to trial, it's typically one of two reasons. One, you've got a client who is refusing to look at the evidence that the state has against them, because I've had plenty of clients where I'm like, come on in. I know you told me that you didn't do this. I'm going to tell you what the state has, and we're going to go through it. We've got some real problems here. Like this isn't some silver tongue magic show. Like, we're going to go in. This is evidence that I have to contend with, and I don't have any way to do it. So, you know, we're probably looking at a conviction here. Like, I'm always very pragmatic and honest with my clients because they deserve that.
Right.
So, and I want them to make informed decisions. So if I get a situation where I got a client saying I didn't do this, well, then my job becomes to look at the evidence and see what I can do with it. And so if Corey has provided Lewis and Nestor with enough that they think they could put on a case to frame this in a different way than the state has framed it, because again, everybody is simply looking at what the state has framed this as being, and that's it. Like, so we've gotten no context from Corey Richens. Everything that we've heard about her being this awful human being has all come from the state's theory of this case. So we have to wait and see. When we are done, when Corey Richens, and I saw this, there was a comment here about that I wanted to point out because it's just not accurate. Cheryl Huffman, 6183, said lawyers are just like doctors and that they'll always publicly defend their respective peers no matter how bad they perform at their job. Keep that in mind. As far as I go, that could not be further from the truth.
Yeah,
From defense attorneys all the time.
Cheryl. You do, yeah. Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
If I think somebody, I call balls and strikes all day long. I've got no vested interest in Corey Richens being innocent or guilty in this case. I'm strictly looking at it from the perspective that I can't avoid, which is that as a defense attorney. And at this point, I want to hear all the evidence. And when I hear all the evidence, I'm either going to come to the conclusion that Corey did it or she didn't. Or that the state hasn't proved it, which is a different thing altogether.
Right, right.
So, and I think that's wonderful. And I thank you so much for always bringing that perspective to this show, because you bring it even in cases, I mean, like this, where it can look pretty damning for one side. You still are challenging us to think. To think and look at it from another perspective, and not just from the state side or the emotional side or this side. And that is always important, because at the end of the day, everything ends up in a gray area. And that's how things are. It's not always absolute this way.
Life is
always
messy, absolute, man. That
way. I'm excited to hear defense. I mean,
yeah, I am.
Bob, I cannot wait to hear what the defense does and puts on because of Bob.
if they go in there and they put on a turd, she's going down.
It is what it is. Yep.
Right. I mean, the reality is they may not have answers. The fascinating part about the defense case in chief, strategically looking at it, is I keep wondering, and Alice and I keep having the conversations, how are they going to get certain things in Corey isn't taking the stand?
Yeah.
But how you get evidence is in a trial is always the biggest piece of the puzzle for both sides.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to get things introduced? Who are we going to bring them in through? Is it hearsay? How do we work around the hearsay rule? Because this is an important statement that the jury needs to hear. So in terms of the defense and how they're going to present their case and what they're going to be limited to based on whether or not Corey Richens is going to testify or not is fascinating. Like that is going to be worth watching the case in chief of the defense in and of itself.
Your thoughts in the comment section on our YouTube and our Substack. The links are in the description. We'd love to get your feedback there. We read it and we'll continue our conversation there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts as well, so you don't miss any of our coverage of this and the many cases we follow for you right here. Until next time, for Todd and Bob and Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The Corey Richens walk the dog letter. We're going to go through it. Break it down for you, explain to you what it all means. This is a 6-page letter that was found in her jail cell that they're trying to, you know, write off as a novel and not explicit instructions for how to lie and manipulate people to make sure Corey's story adds up. Let's start with the defense's official position, because you need to hear it before you hear anything else. And as we go through this, give me your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and on YouTube. The links are in the description. The 6-page letter at the center of this conversation is the one with state evidence numbers stamped across every page. The one prosecutors say is one of the most damning documents in this entire case. It is a letter, according to the prosecution. According to Corey Richens, it's not a letter. It's fiction. It's part of a 65-page mystery manuscript she was writing while in jail. The 6 pages everyone has been talking about are, per the defense, a creative exercise, a character study, a chapter in a book, guys. It's all it is. It doesn't, even though it kind of looks very suspicious, like you're trying to tell us how to answer questions and testify, and it's a manuscript. That's all. It's all it is. Guys, you're crazy. Well, hold that thought, because here is where the letter was found. Not in a writing folder, not in a stack of manuscript pages. It was found hidden inside a book during a search of her jail cell. And here's how it opens. The very first line, before any story, before any chapter, before any plot, walk the dog, but take vague notes so you remember. That's the title. That's the instruction. Memorize what's in here, then walk the dog, meaning get up, go outside, make the letter disappear before anyone finds it. She built the cover up into the first sentence. So ask yourself, does that sound like a novelist setting a scene, or does it sound like someone telling another person to destroy the evidence? Because here's the thing about fiction. It doesn't need a destruction instruction. This letter came with its own cover story baked in. And that tells you everything you need to know before we read a single word of the actual content. Corey Richens, of course, has pled not guilty to all charges and is presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. But we're going to go through this letter, all six pages, and decode exactly what she was trying to communicate, who she was communicating it to, and why prosecutors believe every word of it points in the same direction. So first, who are these people? Corey Richens is a Utah real estate agent and a mother of three, currently on trial for the alleged murder of her husband, Eric Richens. Eric was 39 years old. He died in March of 2022 in their home in Camas, Utah. Medical examiner determined he died of lethal fentanyl overdose. Prosecutors say Corey put it there. She says she didn't. She's pled not guilty to aggravated murder, attempted murder, insurance fraud, and forgery. After Eric died, she wrote a children's book about coping with grief. That detail matters for context. It tells you something about how she processes or performs loss. The letter is written to her mother, Lisa Darden. That's the recipient. That's who she's talking to across these six pages. The woman she closes the letter by calling the best mom in the whole world. Also referenced her brother, who she calls Ronnie throughout. Her defense attorney, Sky Lazaro, referred to simply as Sky, a man she calls Lotto. Eric's sister, Katie Richens Benson, who filed a wrongful death civil suit against Corey after the criminal charges were filed, and several women she assigned specific speaking roles to for national television appearances. Every single one of these people is real. Every single one of them is being handed a task. Keep that in mind as we go through this. Page one. She opens by telling her mother that Sky, her defense attorney, is worried about a specific prosecution argument. The theory is that even if fentanyl was found in gummies in the home, prosecutors will argue that Corey put it there. So the defense needs a counter narrative. They need a way to show that Eric had his own independent source of fentanyl, something that has nothing to do with Corey, something that explains how fentanyl ended up in his body without her involvement. They need something, that Moscow mule that he took that night that she gave him couldn't have been laced with fentanyl. He had to have gotten in his system somewhere else. Corey, sitting in her jail cell, is already solved that problem. The solution? Her brother. Here's what she tells her mother to do. Meet Ronnie in person, not by phone, not by text, because she fears the house and phones are being monitored. Once you're with him, pass along this story. Approximately 1 year before Eric's death, Ronnie was at their house watching football on a Sunday. Eric and Ronnie started talking, and Eric told him that he gets pills and fentanyl from workers at a ranch in Mexico and asked Ronnie to keep it secret from Corey because she'd get mad. Eric told him he kept the drugs hidden in an allergy pill bottle inside his work truck so she wouldn't find him. Now stop. Think of that again. Knowing she's writing this from jail. She writes the setting, football Sunday. She writes the duration, specifically tells her mother to tell Ronnie. It was a quick 2-minute conversation. She's got to have that control. Don't overanalyze it. She writes the dialogue. She writes the emotional motivation. Eric wanted secrecy because of what Corey would think. She writes the physical hiding spot for the drugs. And then she tells her mother to get this story to Ronnie before he meets with Sky, so that when her own brother sits down with her own defense attorney, the story is already locked in. She even reaches for legal framing to package it. She writes, upon information and belief, a phrase used in legal findings to introduce testimony that isn't firsthand knowledge. And then immediately after writing it, she adds, LOL. The LOL is not a throwaway. The LOL tells you she knows exactly what she's doing. She's using legal language deliberately as a wrapper to make a fabricated story sound like legitimate testimony. And so, and she's so comfortable with that, with what she's constructing, that she's laughing at herself while she does it. She closes a section with a line that removes any remaining ambiguity. Reword this however he needs to make the point. Just include it all. It's not a memory. This is a script with editorial notes attached. And understand why the script needs to exist. If her brother testifies that Eric told him a year before his death that he was getting fentanyl from a Mexico ranch, that creates an alternative pathway. It means fentanyl was already in Eric's life independently before Corey allegedly introduced it. It means reasonable doubt. That's what she's building, page by page. From a jail cell, using your own brother as the instrument. But wait, there's more. Woven throughout the same pages is a second narrative she wants distributed across multiple witnesses. The claim that Eric used to hide drugs in her luggage at airports right before boarding, so that if security found anything, Corey would take the fall, not him. Once they landed, she writes, he'd pull the drugs back out of her bag and they'd fight about it. He'd laugh. She was furious. That's the story she once told. Here's the decode. She's not sharing this as a memory. She's preloading it into the record through multiple mouths. If drug evidence surfaces at trial that implicates her, she wants witnesses already on record saying Eric used to set her up for exactly this. She's building a rebuttal before the prosecution finishes making their argument. That's not grief. That's architecture. Page 3. She tells her mother to contact a man she refers throughout as Lotto. This message is simple. Do not text anything that puts the two of them together. Not church, not skiing, not trips, nothing. Her exact words. It doesn't look good. During this trial, testimony has emerged about Corey's alleged boyfriend, a relationship the prosecution has argued as part of the financial motive case. Lotto is likely a reference to that person or someone in a similar role. What she's doing here is trying to erase a relationship from the documentary trail while sitting in jail. No text, no record, no connection, because it doesn't look good. And we all know Corey doesn't like things that don't look good on her, although she only seems to find herself in places that make her not look good. She's managing evidence actively from custody. Page 4 is where it gets darker in a specific way. She tells her mother to go through her phone and find photos of Katie's daughters. Print them. Mail them anonymously to media companies. The goal? Make Katie livid. She adds almost cheerfully, if not, no worries. Why? Why? What are you doing mailing pictures of someone's children to media outlets? And by the way, you dumb bitch, the media outlets, if we get pictures of children, we're not publishing them. They don't do that. We don't do that. Reputable outlets don't do that sort of thing. Oh, look, we got these pictures in the mail from the in-law of Corey Richens. Let's publish them. They must be juicy. Like, this is how this woman thinks. She's not bright. Katie is Katie Richens Benson, Eric's sister, the woman who filed a wrongful death civil lawsuit against Corey after the criminal charges were filed. She's not just a grieving family member. She's a legal adversary. And what Corey is describing is targeted retaliation against that adversary routed through her children's images, executed anonymously to avoid being traced back. Her nieces, she's basically saying, expose their pictures. Like, for what? Why? What are you insinuating is going to happen here? This is going to publish pictures of your nieces that have nothing to do with this? Sorry, Corey, your deflection of attention elsewhere ain't working out too well. If not, no worries is what you need to sit with. She's not struggling or suggesting this is a panic. She's not desperate. She's offering it as a casual option, something to get to when there's a free moment between coordinating Good Morning America appearances and scripting brother testimony. The offhandedness is the tell. She thought through the method, the routing, and the deniability. This isn't impulsive. It's not even impressive. It's calculated enough, though, to include an escape hatch. Page 5 and 6, the coordinates. A Good Morning America interview being arranged by her defense team. And she doesn't just encourage the women involved to share their perspectives. She assigns them lines. Oh. Again, this is the control. This is the control that she feels she needs to have about everything in her life. One is told to bring up that Eric hadn't been to church in the 13 years she'd known him. Oh, he wasn't going to church. Oh, no. This is like, I don't know, maybe in Utah that's like a mortal sin or something. I don't know. Who knows? One is instructed to deliver the airport drug narrative, specifically verbatim, including the detail that Eric would laugh about it and say, well, I can't get in trouble. One is told to describe an incident in Spain where Eric allegedly couldn't drink and spent the trip looking for drugs instead. One is assigned the angle that Eric's sisters were always jealous of Corey, her career, her home, her success. And that this whole case comes down to jealousy, money, and an accidental overdose. Corey just thinks so goddamn much of herself. That last line is worth repeating. She writes, this comes down to jealousy, money, and Eric's partying that they don't want to acknowledge, and sadly, an accidental overdose. That is the conclusion she wants delivered on national television, assigned to a specific person before a jury is seated. She's not asking these women to tell the truth. She's distributing a narrative with assigned roles, specific talking points, and a premeditated or predetermined conclusion. That's not a support network. That's a production. And then at the end of page 6, after all of it, the brother scripted testimony, the airport drug container narrative, counter narrative, the erased relationship, the retaliation against Eric's sister through her children, the coordinated television strategy. She asked her mother to smuggle Crest White strips into her jail cell through her attorney's envelope. Her teeth have gotten yellow, too much coffee and tea. She's managing her smile. For the cameras, she's already booked. She's thinking, at the end of 6 pages of what prosecutors call a witness tampering scheme, about what she's going to look like on the other side of this, not whether she'll get there, what she'll look like when she does. The letter closes, I love you, I love you, I love you. Hang in there. We're getting there slowly. You're the best mom in the whole world. We're getting there. Now, back to the defense's position. This is fiction, a 65-page manuscript, a creative exercise. Here's why prosecutors say that argument falls apart under its own weight. It was hidden inside a book in her jail cell, not organized in manuscript pages. The title is A Destruction Instruction, novelists don't tell their readers to burn chapter one. It's addressed to her real mother by implication and references her real attorney by name. It contains accurate, specific details about her actual legal strategy and her real case. And it ends with, I love you, I love you, I love you, which is, to anyone paying attention, a hell of a way to close a chapter of fiction. A 12-person jury is now looking at this letter. They are looking at it in a courtroom where, because of legal constraints around Corey's detention, they're not even supposed to know it came from a jail cell. Prosecutors are actively working through how to present it without revealing that detail. The letter that was supposed to disappear on a dog walk is now the subject of courtroom arguments about how best to show it to the people who decide her fate. Eric Richens was 39 years old. He died in his home. His children are growing up without him. And if prosecutors are right, the person who allegedly put fentanyl in his system spent the years it followed using her mother as a courier, her brother as a witness, her friend as a media team, and a stranger's children as leverage, or her sister-in-law's children as leverage, all from a jail cell, all while worrying about her teeth. She called it walk the dog. She thought it would vanish. 12 people are reading it right now. Good job, Corey. You're a smart one. Some monsters, right? I don't even say people, because this doesn't even feel, it's like there's just certain folks that have this operational modality to them that is just, it doesn't even feel human. It feels like something else. Maybe that's the scariest part about these people, is they are human, and this is the modality of some humans, whether the rest of us want to believe it or not. That's what makes it so hard to accept, so hard to believe. That's why she's on trial. That's why it's not just, yeah, you did this. Because there's a world where there's plenty of people that relate enough to her way of thinking that may go, and then run it through their mind of like, they might do the same thing at some point in time. And if they might do it, well then, better not put that one away, because what if it came down to me? Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. The links are in the description. Love to see you there. We'll continue our conversation in the comments. Until then, my name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.